From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia's foster system is in crisis. The number of kids in care rose almost 60% between 2010 and 2017. More than 20,000 children have been in state custody so far this year. Samantha Max has been covering foster care in Middle Georgia as health reporter for The Telegraph in Macon and joins us from our bureau there now. Samantha, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And John DeGarmo, he is director of the Foster Care Institute. He and his wife have also been foster parents to dozens of children, and that's for more than a decade. He's joining us on the line from Monticello. John, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on the program.
Well, thank you both. Samantha, you report that Georgia has a foster care problem, which is two-pronged. What do you mean by that?
There are more kids in foster custody than ever before, but there aren't enough houses to keep up with them. So you see this demand rising, but the supply is just not keeping up. So you have to think about where do those kids go when there aren't enough foster homes for them.
So why is there this recent jump in children in the system?
It's actually been a pretty steady increase over the years, for many years now, but especially really since 2012 is when, or 2010 is when the uptick began again. And there slew of different, you know, factors that can be at play there, whether it's poverty, whether it's instability, but also things like the opioid crisis or a new hotline was put in place recently to report different situations where kids maybe should be put in the foster system. So it's kind of this perfect storm of all of these different things coming together.
We're going to look at some of those reasons in more detail. But John, first, is Georgia worse off than other states? Is this really a crisis?
Oh, absolutely it's a crisis. Yes, I've had the privilege of traveling across the country, working with foster care agencies, and Georgia's got a particular problem that is just not going away.
Yeah, well, this is something that Samantha has looked into down to the county level in Middle Georgia. Samantha, does Division of Family and Child Services in Bibb County, where you are, have the budget for this increased number of kids in care?
Bibb County's DFACS office gets funding from a collection of both county, state, and federal funds, and most of it is coming from the state and federal level. But for years now, the county has also pitched in, and a lot of times that funding might actually be used for matching for the state and federal funds. But this year, our local budget faced a bit of a crisis. Over the summer, we missed our deadline to pass a new budget, and there was an argument over raising property rates. Essentially, what happened was that a lot of agencies saw cuts to their budgets, and the Division of Family and Children's Services actually faced the greatest cut of 25%. All of a sudden, they had about $200,000 less to work with.
That's significant. How many children in Bibb County are in state custody? And how many foster homes are there under DFACS?
As of mid-October, when I was reporting this story, there were 265 children in state custody, but only 60 DFACS foster homes.
John, Samantha mentioned that one obstacle is not just about funding, but the insufficient number of foster parents out there who can take kids in. Why don't more people want to foster children?
That's a great question. So many people have misconceptions, and I had those misconceptions myself before I was a foster parent. Misconceptions that people have to have a big house or a large income, or the children are bad, and all those are false. You don't have to have a big house. You don't have to be married. You don't have to have a large income. And the children are simply victims of abuse or neglect or abandonment. These children are victims, and they're just looking for somebody to give them a chance and help them. But the other factor is this. Foster parents feel that they do not get the support they need during times of grief and loss or burnout and stress. And what I mean by grief and loss is this. When a child comes into my home as a foster parent, there's not a label. There's no label of biological or adoptive or foster. They're all my children, and I love them with all my heart unconditionally, so that when they leave the home, for whatever reason it may be, when they return back to their biological parents or they age out or whatever it may be, it's like losing my own child. And so many foster parents suffer from what is known as compassion fatigue or secondary traumatic stress, and they have those feelings of grief and loss. And that's very hard for a foster parent recover from if they're not getting the support that they need.
Let's talk about that. In May, my GPB colleague Leah Fleming interviewed Virginia Pryor. She was then director of the Georgia of DFACS, the Georgia Division of Family and Child Services. Here she is explaining the nuances of serving families and children in Georgia.
every family's different, every family's need is different, and every child's need is different. So, you know, at the highest level, we have to make sure that children are safe and that families have the supports that they need to be able to appropriately care for their child.
What I heard from you, John, is that on the ground, the system doesn't really have the capacity to address those different needs
of
different
families. The larger number of children coming in to the foster care system, mainly due to the opioid crisis, today's caseworkers are simply overworked, overwhelmed, and under-resourced. They don't have the resources themselves, the caseworkers, and as a result, they can't give the foster parents the need that they need. And also, foster parenting, it's a challenging job. You know, for me, it's the most rewarding thing I've done, but at the same time, it's the most challenging thing I've done. When children come into a home who are suffering from anxieties and suffering from traumas and abuse and suffering from attachment issues or issues of trust, you know, that's a challenge on a family. So it's a very stressful job.
Well, I want to ask you about how you and your wife made the decision to take the plunge, 10 years ago, to take kids in?
Oh, well, actually, we've been doing it for 16 years now, and we did it because, our first child died of a condition called anencephaly, or some pronounce it anencephaly. It's a condition where the brain or skull never truly forms. And afterwards, after we had three children after that, I recognized when I moved to Georgia and teaching in a rural high school setting that there were so many children in this rural setting who were having issues of behavior or academics or attendance in schools. And I kept wondering, what is this? What is the correlation? And then I met some of their birth parents. And then I truly realized, yes, it starts in the home. I had lost my first child. How can I help these other children who are suffering in some way? And that led the decision of foster parenting.
Well, I'm so sorry about your loss, but also really heartened by what you've taken on. In fact, you and your wife recently founded Never Too Late. This is a group home for adolescent boys in Monticello. You opened it in part because of the foster care shortage or the shortage of homes in Middle Georgia.
Right? Yeah, that's correct. My wife and I have had as many as 11 children placed in our house at the same time. And the state number is 6, but there's such a need in our area that we've signed waiver after waiver, if you will. And we recognize that, you know what, we cannot continue taking 9, 10, 11 kids in our own home, but how can we help more children? How can we take it up to another level? You know, the statistics are very grim for children when they age out of foster care. 55% of these children will drop out of school. 65% will end up homeless. 75% will spend time incarcerated. And like so many others, the cycle will repeat itself for the next generation. So we thought, how can we help more? How can we stop this vicious cycle? So we have opened up a residential home for boys in our area.
That's John DeGarmo. He and his wife founded Never Too Late, a group home for adolescent boys in Monticello, Georgia. Also with us, Samantha Max, who reports for the Telegraph of Macon, has been following the story about the strains on the foster care system. Much of it's having to do with the cascading effects of the opioid crisis. Samantha, what kind of stories or kids did you meet that were caught up in that addictive cycle?
I did not come across specifically any kids who had made it into the foster system because of the opioid crisis, mostly because of privacy issues. But if you look at the reports and all of the national data, you can see that obviously the opioid epidemic has reached every corner of this country. And, you know, you think about people who are using opioids, it really spans the gamut of every age group, every population, and a lot of times they have kids. So you think about if someone is addicted to drugs, how can they really care for a child? And a lot of times they do need that support from the state.
John, as a foster parent, have you taken in any kids who were caught up in this swirl of addiction?
Absolutely, almost every day. To be sure, when we're seeing more parents addicted to drugs and we're seeing more parents incarcerated because of opiates or hospitalized or even dying because of the opioid crisis, where are these children going? They're flooding into a foster care system in our state that cannot handle it. And I've had child time after time after time placed in my home whose parents have been addicted to opiates in some way. Oh, my goodness. In fact, I've adopted 3 children from the foster care system. 2 of them are third-generation foster care, which means their parents and their grandparents were also in foster care and due mainly to the opioid crisis.
And does that happen frequently, multi-generational foster care?
Yes. sadly, it does. Sadly, it is something. When these children do age out and they don't get the support they need, they don't have the stability, they don't have those living skills or social skills or even high school diploma to fall back upon, yes, for so many of these children, it starts again for their next generation.
And aging out is what, 18? What is the age here in Georgia?
That is correct. Now, 18. Now, there is a program where the children can sign themselves back in, if you will, if they go to college or they have some type of independent living program. But sadly, so many of these youth do not take that program. And they do it simply because, in their mind, in their eyes, they don't want to be labeled a foster child. No one wants that label. And in their mind, the foster care system has failed them in some way.
So there is a stigma not only from outside of the system, you talked about some of the misconceptions, but even within it that people don't want to be identified as a foster kid.
Oh, absolutely. Who wants that label? When a child is placed into my home as a foster parent, you know, I used to think they wanted to be in my home, that I was helping them, but that's the opposite effect. You know, I can give them all that stability and that security and that unconditional love, if you will, but at the end of the day, they want to go back to their norm, even if their norm was an abusive environment. And they want to go back to their mommy and their daddy, even if it was a horrific situation, because that's their norm, that's their family in their sense, and society has placed a negative stereotype on foster children, if you will, that label. And again, no child wants that label placed upon them.
Well, Samantha, you report that the Division of Family and Child Services, again, DFACS, their primary goal is to keep families together. Now, officials have told you that they are ramping up on those efforts because of the influx of kids into the system. So what is DFACS now doing in terms of early intervention?
I think the goal is always family reunification. You know, when you're a kid, you want to stay with your biological parents. And when you're a parent, you don't want to be separated from your child, even if circumstances sometimes get in the way. So I think what DFACS has really chosen to do, and this is not new, but really just ramping up the efforts, is putting in the support before a child needs to be removed. They can connect them with therapeutic counseling, whether that be in their home or taking them to outpatient counseling, and really just having caseworkers work with them to see what are the patterns, what are the issues, how can all members of the family work together to make it a more stable environment for the children or the child. And another thing is sometimes people just need to be connected to resources that either they didn't know were available or didn't know how to find, whether that's SNAP benefits or the Women and Infant and Children Program. There are so many resources that perhaps people aren't aware of, and it's really just a matter of having that guiding hand help them find the support they need.
Well, you are describing what sounds like very active, directed, and focused interface with people who are in the foster system and the state. Is it really out there?
You would hope that it would be. And I think that every person who works every day for the Division of Family and Children Services is going above and beyond to provide those services. However, there just is a shortage of caseworkers. When I spoke with Ms. Shannon Fields, who's the director of our field office here in Bibb County, she said that she was hoping to take on more caseworkers in the coming year. However, because of the county budget cuts, that's a project they're going to have to put on hold. And I'm sure that that's the case at different offices across the state, probably even across the country.
Samantha Max, John DeGarmo, stay with me. We're going to take a short break and come back and get to some of the reasons that may be at the root of the increase in children in foster care services in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Tens of thousands of children in Georgia are in foster care this November, which is National Adoption Month. Samantha Max is a reporter at The Telegraph in Macon. She's been reporting on what is becoming a crisis in Georgia's foster care system, too many kids and too few homes. John DeGarmo is also with me. He is a foster parent himself and has been many, many times. He's also director of the Foster Care Institute. So, Samantha, you do report that children who spend time in foster care suffer mental health issues at higher rates, something that John echoed earlier. So what are some of the consequences and ways of building trust with kids who have that kind of emotional baggage that they're carrying?
That's a really good question. And I've spoken with multiple therapists who specialize in this. What they see often is that just so many children who have spent time in foster custody are suffering from trauma. I mean, if you think about it, whether it's the experience that they're coming from in their biological home, the actual act of being separated from their biological family, and then, you know, what happens next if they go to one home, multiple homes after that, it's really just a very tumultuous situation to find yourself in, especially as a child. So those effects will linger with them if they don't get the support that they need. And even if they do get the support that they need, you know, that's never something that you can erase. One therapist who I spoke with who specializes in children who have spent time in foster custody and who actually has adopted four of her own foster children, she basically told me that as a counselor, what she really has to do is help children take back control of their story. You know, so many things have been outside of their control in the past, and they pick up these behaviors, whether it's maybe hoarding food, being aggressive, things that oftentimes adults or bystanders may not understand what the roots of those behaviors are. But if you look at the trauma that they've experienced, you can kind of break it down with them and help them understand, you know, this is a chapter of your story, but you can write the next chapter and you can take control with your own voice.
John, this is something that you've seen, I'm sure, over and over again, this trope about children in foster care badly behaved. Is it the trauma that we've been discussing, and how do you as parents cope with that?
Well, you know, you hit something that's very important there, and Samantha did as well. When a child goes from one home to the next home, which is known as multiple displacement, and sadly happens to so many children in foster care. In fact, I've worked with some children across the country who have been in 30, 40, 50 different homes. You can imagine what that does to an attachment, issues with a child, or issues of trust. And then when they go from one home to the next, many doctors will prescribe them more and more medication. So it's often the case where children in foster care are over-medicated with psychotropic drugs. All of this plays a part of the issues of anxiety that these children face. It is challenging. On top of that, no child wants to be placed in my home as a foster child. So it takes time. Foster parents must be very understanding, very committed, very patient, compassionate, and to provide what the child needs more than anything else, and that is to love that child despite all of these challenges they bring in the home. But yes, it is challenging for a foster parent, and that's one of the reasons why foster parents burn out when they don't get a break that they need.
So what then is your message, John, to other people who are considering becoming foster parents?
Well, my message is this. To begin with, if you are considering becoming a foster parent, the first thing you need to do is talk to your partner or your spouse to make sure that both of you are on board, both of you are committed, because it will take both of you to do so. To me, it's been the most rewarding thing I've ever done. Every child that's come in my home has changed me, has made me a better person in some way. And I want to let people know this. As a foster parent, you might not change the world, but for these children, their world will be changed because of what you do.
John, how about your message to kids who are hoping to or waiting to be adopted?
I would tell those children who are out there, who are in the foster care system, I would tell them this, that there is somebody out there right now who is praying for them, who is wanting to help them. Not everybody can be a foster parent, but everybody can help in some way. And there are those people out there right now who are wanting to help a child in foster care, a youth in foster care, to provide them with support, provide them with school supplies, and provide them with mentoring and tutoring, to provide them with so much. And I would tell that child right now who is waiting for someone to adopt them, there's a family right now who is ready for you.
John DeGarmo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John and his wife are longtime foster care parents. He's director of the Foster Care Institute, and they recently opened a group home for boys in Monticello, Georgia. Samantha Max, health reporter for The Telegraph, thanks so much for your reporting on this.
Thanks so much for having me.
At 23, Lauren Simmons became the youngest woman ever to work as a full-time trader on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. She is only the second African-American woman to hold this role. And now a movie is being made about the Marietta-raised game changer. Actress Kiersey Clemons announced that she is starring in and producing a movie based on Simmons' life. We spoke with Simmons about her experiences at Rosenblatt Securities Firm and what it is like to be the only woman on that bustling trade floor.
It's funny, your path, you studied genetics at Kennesaw State University with plans to go to medical school. So how did you get into trading?
My senior year of college, I was writing my thesis, and I realized that that wasn't the direction I wanted to go into. I knew I still wanted to go to New York, so the day I graduated, December 13th, I hopped on a plane, came to New York, and from there, reached out to many different people on LinkedIn, and connected with Gordon Sharlup, who knew Richard Rosenblatt, and that's how I got onto the trading floor.
Yeah, so it is all who you know, although there are people who've asked you, was it a father, an uncle, somebody who gave you a way in, was it?
No, I had zero connections to the floor.
So you did this yourself?
I did.
Lauren, it wasn't just networking. I mean, to be a trader on the floor, you have to have a badge, and to get a badge, you have to pass a test. What was that process like?
So yes, the test, in order to get a badge on the floor, you have to take a test. And the test is, I believe, 100 questions. And it is not easy. The information is not something you can get from Google. You get a study guide from the exchange, and they say, good luck. I think, you know, if 10 people were to take the test, 2 would pass. So it was very stressful.
Were you surprised? Were people surprised when you said, I made it, I passed?
Yes, because not only that, you don't get the results immediately. You have to wait 5 hours and they give you a piece of paper. And my anxiety was crazy high, but I was like, whatever happens, happens. And they came over, they gave me my paper, and I don't even think I believed I passed when she gave me the paper. She's like, you passed. And I'm like, is this real? Are we serious? And everyone was shocked.
Amazing. So how about that first time you stepped out onto the floor? What did that feel like?
The first time I stepped on the floor, again, my anxiety was at an all-time high, especially when I got my first order. And right before you send out an order, you have to press the send button, and it says confirm. And I'm, you know, it was a scary moment, but once I press confirm and sent out the first order, I knew that this is where I wanted to be, that I could do it, and everything was going to be okay.
I'm not laughing at your anxiety, but the fact that you admit it, you have it, and you just pressed on anyway, what is it about you that leads you there, that gets you over that anxious hump?
I know that this is absolutely different, but I have a twin brother, and he has cerebral palsy, and his personality is larger than life, and I kind of live vicariously through him. My personality, if anyone meets me, I'm not as bubbly as him, and he just gives me a lot of motivation to live life to the fullest and to do it being fearless.
So he must be so proud of you.
He is. Yeah. I don't think he can totally grasp, but he absolutely is.
Well, here is the rather iconic, let's say, stock trader Peter Tuckman talking about the male-dominated culture of Wall Street, where you work.
It's a bit of a men's club. It's always been that way. Why are there no women in this business? It's because men suck. The environment towards women still hasn't changed in so many respects.
Lauren, we've gotten so many glimpses of this, you know, from movies from The Wolf of Wall Street to, let's see, American Psycho, the aggressive alcohol drinking, prostitute frequenting kind of traders on Wall Street. What do you think about being in that environment? What does it feel like to be in that culture?
You know, it is a boys' club down there, but the men on the floor, it is a great community, and they all want to see me succeed. So they are great mentors. They're pushing me up. They want to see me have a successful career within finance, and it's a good environment. I Hollywood glamorizes it to be one thing, but it's completely different on the floor. I mean, it is a boys' club, so, you know, there are a lot of things going on, but it is a big supportive community down on the trading floor.
Wow, that's good to hear. What do you think it is about that environment that is keeping women out of the business?
I think people just, you know, they see themselves sitting there in a meeting with 20 other men, and that is frightening, knowing that they are the only female. I think if people get more outside of their heads and just go for what they actually want to do, whether that's trading or being in finance or being somewhere where they are the minority, there's less fear in that, and they can strive and go on and do whatever they want. But I think it's a fear factor.
What about some of the practical day-to-day pieces or challenges of being the only woman in the room?
When I first started, I'm from the South, so I definitely have that Southern personality and often nice. And I don't think that's changed much, but definitely making my voice heard is something that I have done and that they actually listen. And I think that was definitely a challenge when I first got onto the floor, just making my voice heard. So that's talking over everyone, being loud, and being a vocal point within the crowd. But once I was able to accomplish that, they listened to me all the time.
And how about those horrible jackets? Do you have to wear those jackets?
Yeah, so the jacket, they all come in men's sizes, and I'm very tiny. I'm 5'1". So I think the smallest size they have is a 34, and I'm not. So it always just looks like I'm wearing, you know, my father's jacket, or not mine, but the most important thing is to wear the badge. The badge is what we've all worked for, to be on the trading floor. It is a number that you get to pick. I chose mine, 8/11, my birthday. So it's very symbolic, and that above anything else is the most important thing.
I'm trying to picture you. You know, I think of these pictures that I've seen of traders on the floor just in a mass yelling at each other or holding their heads in their hands, and you 5'1" in this jacket that probably comes down below your knees yelling at the top of your lungs. Is that you?
Yeah. You got it in a nutshell. I mean, we've gotten it tailored, but the jacket it's gonna be a thing. It is what it is.
Well, now, for the first time in 226 years of existence, the New York Stock Exchange has a woman president, Stacey Cunningham, appointed last month. Here's a clip of an interview that she did with NPR's Weekend Edition.
I think the more women you have in an industry, the less likely we are to struggle with people not being treated appropriately. So if we focus on having more diversity in our industries, I think we'll be better off.
So I imagine she also began as a Wall Street trader. What did that feel like to have a woman at the top now?
I think it's amazing. Stacey is great. I know her, and with her being a woman, there will be more diversity. I believe they're in the process of hiring more women to come onto the trading floor. And the culture will change. It's not a bad culture on the trading floor, like I said before, but again, with the woman president of the New York Stock Exchange, there will be more women present throughout the organization.
So the trading floor is one thing. How about hanging out with your colleagues afterwards? Is that something you do?
Oh, we're all very close. It's a good environment. It's a safe environment. We're with each other from 9 a.m. to 4, I guess every regular work day, but the pods that we're in are very small. And again, it's the New York Stock Exchange trading floor. It's, you know, not a corporation. It's a big community, a small community, but a big community of all of us, and we're really close.
You know, Lauren, so many times when people are pioneers in any kind of field, they have drive and determination, and absolutely, it sounds like you know what you're doing and what you're about. But a lot of pioneers struggle with this kind of imposter syndrome, that they're not really up to the task and that everybody's going to see that. What do you feel when you look around the room and see that you are the only woman there?
I don't really notice it. I know that might sound crazy, but the job that we do is all the same. Doing the job, knowing that you're qualified, knowing that you have it, is, you know, you'll succeed. It's in getting out of your head. I mean, oftentimes I have to, you know, scale back and, you know, can I do this? But I know I can, and just continuing to do my job and to do it well.
Well, I know that as an African-American woman from the South, a lot of people are looking to you and saying, this is great, this is a model for me. But in the end, would you like to be known just as an exemplary trader, not just the only woman on the floor, or not just one of two African-American female full-time traders?
You know, the trading floor is a great starting place for someone who is young, and the learning curve is extreme. But you learn so much while being down there, and then you go on and you do other amazing things within the financial industry, which I know I'll do. So this is only a starting place.
Well, keep on rolling. Lauren Simmons, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Lauren Simmons, the only full-time female trader at the New York Stock Exchange. And she's from Marietta, Georgia. A movie about her life starring actress Kiersey Clemons was just announced. Coming up, we add some new books to our Southern Reading List with the authors Becky Albertalli and Adam Silvera. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The nights are getting longer and the day is getting colder. It is high time to curl up with a book this holiday season. Becky Albertalli and Adam Silvera are authors of What If It's Us, a young adult novel about two teens who fall in love over a summer in New York City. Here are Becky and Adam's additions to our Southern Reading List. That's our series of authors and readers sharing books that define and reflect the South.
Like the first time I read, I just, you know, I remember crying while reading it. And then crying while talking to her about reading it. I'm Becky Albertalli, and I am the author of Simon Versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda, which is the Love, Simon book, The Upside of Unrequited, Leah on the Offbeat, and the recently released What If It's Us, co-authored with Adam Silvera. So one Southern author that I have been really excited about these days is actually somebody who has spoken with GPB before, Nick Stone, who is from Atlanta, lives in Atlanta. Her first book is called Dear Martin, and it was one of my absolute favorites last year. But I'm really excited about her second book, Odd One Out, which came out on October 9th. And it is like a triple point of view story about three teenagers. It's a YA book. It is YA contemporary, and it is funny and voicey. And it's about kind of a very complicated relationship between these three teenagers.
We live in a pretty progressive area, as Mama likes to put it. And barring one incident in ninth grade involving some bigots picketing at one of my basketball games in deep South Georgia, the two dad life has never really been a big deal. I'm so used to it not being a big deal, in fact, that Dr. Chin's shock catches me off guard. And now I'm really curious about Ray. It's crystal clear to me that Jupe was flirting with her, so Ray either didn't realize or didn't mind.
I discovered her. It was actually a really interesting story. It was kind of a meet cute. So when I first met Nick Stone, it was at my launch party for my debut book, Simon Versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda. And she was there in the audience. I completely remember her. I had never met her before, but she asked a question. She's just so cool. Like, just her presence, everything about her so cool. And she emailed me later. And, you know, in the email, she had read my book at that point. And one of the things that she mentioned is she was a debut author herself, and she had a book deal with Crown Random House, and her book hadn't come out yet at the time. But she and I met up. It turns out, like, our kid, you know, our older sons are a week apart. And so I was lucky enough to read Dear Martin early, and it absolutely blew me away. Like, the first time I read, I just, you know, I remember crying while reading it. And then crying while talking to her about reading it and just trying to get through that conversation where I was trying to explain to her how much I loved her book. And then I don't think I was particularly articulate trying to explain that to her, but I do think she got the message because that book is gut-wrenching and it's a tough read. You know, it's kind of a Black Lives Matter themed book, and it is... it's not the most lighthearted topic to read about, but it's incredibly important to be reading those kinds of stories. And, you know, and Nick Stone has a way of telling those kinds of stories that's not only accessible in general, but she really is a way of connecting with teenagers, and including teens who maybe aren't super into reading. You know, like I would say Nick's books are top of my list to hand to kids who, you know, may not be that bookworm kid with like a big stack of books on their nightstand. Like, speaking as that bookworm kid, I can confirm that her books are also for the bookworm kid or adult. But yeah, you know, she reaches a really broad audience, and that's something that's really special.
I vividly remember sitting at the edge of the bed in the studio that I was living in, like getting to like the last like 40 pages and watching everything come together. It's really masterfully told. Hi, I'm Adam Silvera, the author of More Happy Than Not and History Is All You Left Me, and They Both Die at the End, and I'm the co-author of the recently released What If It's Us? So one of my favorite books that takes place in the South is Where Things Come Back by John Corey Whaley, and I'm from New York City, and I'm like used to sort of like this like bustling energy, you know, and then to read this story that is like very atmospheric with its sort of slow crawl and knowing the people in your town versus juxtaposed with like me passing hundreds of strangers every day. You know, that was a really incredible experience for me. And then you throw this this like small town mystery into it as well. And it's very clear why it was an award-winning debut.
I was 17 years old when I saw my first dead body. It wasn't my cousin Oslo's. It was a woman who looked to have been around 50 or at least in her late 40s. She didn't have any visible bullet holes or scratches, cuts or bruises, so I assumed that she had just died of some disease or something, her body barely hidden by the thin white sheet as it awaited its placement in the lockers. The second dead body I ever saw was my cousin Oslo's. I recognized his dirty brown shoes immediately as the woman wearing the bright white coat grasped the metallic handle and yanked hard to slide the body out from the silvery wall. "That's him," I said to her. "You sure?" "Positive."
It was in 2012, so I would have been a little before I turned 22 years old. And that was around a time where I was finally reading more contemporary novels. Like, I grew up on fantasy, and I was rereading Harry Potter over and over again. So I was, like, finally, like, getting introduced to new voices. And I was a bookseller at the time, so I was fairly tapped into which books were, you know, being released and stuff like that. But this book had gone completely under my radar. And then it, you know, went on to win the Michael L. Prince Award, which is celebrated for the best young adult novel of the year. And then it also won the William C. Morris Award, which was praised for the best young adult debut. And I'm like, whoa, what is this book that like had completely like missed my attention? And then I read it in one sitting, which is incredible for me because I am a very slow reader. I was underlining passages and highlighting. And I vividly remember sitting at the edge of the bed in the studio that I was living in, like getting to like the last like 40 pages and watching everything come together. It's really masterfully told. There's also this really touching brotherhood in the book, and just this character who, Cullen Witter, the main character, who wants more for himself. And I remember feeling that way, you know, like I grew up not having a lot. I grew up wondering if I would ever sort of achieve my dreams and wanting sort of like to escape. And that energy was very easy to connect with. And and again, like this mystery was so layered, and it's narrated both from Cullen's point of view, in addition to some like interstitial passages, and watching everything come together. It's an incredible collision, and I've read that book probably like 3 times now.
You feel like you're friends with her and just kind of walking with her through this really tough experience. It might be a little strange to say this because this is a book that is very deliberately set in kind of an every town. So it doesn't have a specific setting in the book. But I'm going to say The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. So when you read the book, when you see the movie, it feels very Southern. And I think, you know, that's largely because Angie Thomas herself, the author, was born and raised in Jackson, Mississippi. And Garden Heights, the community, the town where the main character star lives and where the events of the book take place, is based on Angie's neighborhood in Jackson growing up. You know, it's this really rich story that feels just so complex and human. And you know, you get to know this main character, Star Carter, this little girl. She's not little, she's 16, but, you know, she's like, gosh, you get to know her so well. It feels like you feel like you're friends with her and just kind of walking with her through this really tough experience that she goes through. And, you know, by the end of the book, the way you feel kind of seeing Star off to go, you know, live the rest of her life. You know, it's one of those books where you're really satisfied. Like, it's a very satisfying ending. But it's kind of like that Harry Potter thing where you have to have a good cry because of the book itself and then a second cry because the book's over.
Becky Albertalli and Adam Silvera, authors of What If It's Us. Albertalli is author of Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda, which was made into the film Love, Simon earlier this year. In addition to recommending books for our Southern reading list, Becky and Adam spoke about their friendship and the process of writing a book together over many texts and emails.
So we met online in the beginning of 2013 after we sold our debut novels. So we share a literary agent and it was really exciting. Our books were like announced in the same week as well, just a couple days apart. And shortly after that, we traded manuscripts with each other. So these were not like the final versions of our books. But, you know, I got to read Simon versus the Homo Sapiens Agenda in December 2013. And Becky got to read my debut novel, More Happy Than Not. And we were just like geeking out over how much we loved these books. Like, I still have this memory of like going on a date that month and like not wanting to be on the date anymore because I just kept thinking about the book. And I had texted my agent and he was like, go on your date, like the book's going to be there. And like the date was not great. And I was like, I could have been home reading this book. So no more like life advice from my agent. But it was like this really special feeling. And then we were just like emailing each other over the holidays as we read each other's books.
Yeah, and it was one of those like really fast friendships that like clicked into place right away. And so, you know, we started talking about, you know, the book idea that eventually became What If It's Us. We started talking about that in like February of 2014. We still had not met in person, but at this point, and this is just from like December to February, our like email correspondence had escalated to the point where, you know, we were sharing some of the like very embarrassing, detailed stories from, you know, just earlier experiences, earlier dating experiences, or, you know, in my case, earlier experiences of wanting to date and not getting any action, but, you know, just the different ways that played out. And, you know, and I think it was from one of those stories that, you know, there's just this like seed of an idea in, you know, a really embarrassing story from my 20s that like hit Adam in a certain way. And Adam was the one who was like, you know, we should write a YA book about misconnections.
Yeah. And then we just continued to develop who these boys were. Like, we had their names like very like soon after that. And their names didn't change. Like, they were always Arthur and Ben. I remember, like, Becky had Arthur before I had Ben. Like, for the longest, it was, like, Arthur and Guy was, like, my stand-in name. But then once I was, like, Ben, like, that, and it clicked. And then we just continued to sort of, like, throughout the years, up until we finally wrote the book last year in 2017, like, we were just, like, how cool would it be if this happened? And how can we push the story this way? And so we were finally in position to finally write the book. So I remember the first time when I met Becky, it felt like a first date because like it's like, you know, especially like if it, like an online dating, I guess, would be the sort of like equivalence of this here, where it's like yeah, you've been exchanging so many messages and everything seems to be going well, but it's like, oh my God, what if you like hate me in real life? And what if I say something stupid that's like irreparable? And yeah, so it just like, I remember like we met like on the corner, like up until the day that we met, we also hadn't even been on the phone until, talked on the phone until earlier that day. And yeah, so then it was just like, but then we just like finally met. And I think it was like outside, sort of like outside like a Rite Aid or CVS or something, and where Becky was standing when I first saw her. And it was like, yeah.
To make it a really special first date too, like that day that we met, I was like 8 weeks pregnant. Wasn't planning to tell anybody yet, but like for, you know, this is with my second son. For each of my pregnancies, there's been one day where I've just been really, really sick all day. And I was lucky, like only one day per pregnancy. It was that day. So I remember that first phone call, the first time I ever heard Adam's voice. I was like, hi, I'm Becky. I've been throwing up all day. I still want to meet up. I'm not sick. Here's what's up. And so Adam, I remember, you know, and Adam was an absolute sweetheart, of course. And so our first date was like sitting in a diner with me sort of picking around the edges of like a pancake or something, you know, just in like drinking water and trying to be present as a human being on earth without ruining, you know, a very important meet cute, yeah, in my life, what would turn out to be like a very important friendship, like in my life. It was, yeah, that's a strange thing that happened on that day.
Yeah, you're pregnant with another man's baby on our first day.
I know. I know. I'm sorry, Adam.
Respect.
The different details that show up in the book are, you know, and some of them are very consciously drawn from our own experiences, our lives, our friendship, or other things like unrelated to our friendship, but that are still a part of our lives. But what surprises me is we keep finding little details that, you know, are pulled from our own experiences, but like very much accidentally. And sometimes we don't realize it until, you know, after the book has been finalized for months.
Yeah, like my character, Ben, he is going through a breakup at the beginning of the book. And I was in a relationship that was like approaching its end for sure, whether I wanted to like acknowledge that or not at the time. And when I was like reading it back recently, I was like, oh my God, yeah, no, I was definitely going through this, like when I was writing these sections, which was just so wild. Like, yeah, it's just, writing is therapeutic that way, whether you realize it or not.
That was Becky Albertalli and Adam Silvera, authors of What If It's Us? It's a YA novel about a summer romance in New York City, and it's about to be made into a movie. And that's our show for today. We would love to hear from you. Which books are on your list to give or receive this holiday season? You can leave us a message at 404-500-9457 or reach us on Twitter or on our Facebook group. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Tyler Morris is our engineer, and Amy Kiley is our senior producer. We get help from Dawn Smith. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. This is On Second Thought.